On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
For a lot of it, it's hard to believe, but it's been 20 years since that lovely day in September that turned so terribly tragic and changed everything about the world. We're talking about, of course, the 20th anniversary of September 11th and the attacks on America. Here with us today is Doug Keeney, historian, researcher, speaker, and author of more than a dozen books on American history. His latest book is The Lives They Saved, the untold story of medics, mariners, and the incredible boat lift that evacuated nearly 300,000 people on 9/11. It's from Lyons Press. That's L-Y-N-O-S Press. And Doug, thank you so much for being with us today on the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's an important day in our history.
It absolutely is, and it's really been bothersome to me that it doesn't seem in a lot of situations that people are even remembering that it took place. For those of us who were adults at that time, we can never forget it. That's one of those indelible moments of our lives. And for the younger generation, they need to be told so that they understand what's the big deal, what was the big deal about 20 years in Afghanistan, and so forth. So I think this is a very timely book. But also, I have to say, for those of us who are not in and around New York, we kind of forget, I know this sounds silly, but we kind of forget that there's a large part of New York City that's on islands, and that and the evacuation, you know, it's fairly really interesting. When I got your book and I started reading, I thought, wait, they used boats? You know, like I don't remember that being talked about very much at the time. And this is a great story.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I tell people that too. I was doing work on another book, and I saw an exhibit in a museum in New Jersey about the evacuation of New York City on 9/11, and I thought, what evacuation? Turns out there were almost 300,000 New Yorkers evacuated from Manhattan on September 11th. Many of those people were saved. Their lives were literally saved because some smart medic put them on a boat and pointed over to the Jersey shore, which is only a 5-10 minute boat ride across the Hudson River from the World Trade Center. And I think one of these things that's kind of important to know is why. Why were people directed to the boats on September 11th? And one of the key facts is they didn't know anything. Down at the World Trade Center at Ground Zero, no one had any idea what was really going on in a bigger sense. Was this an all-out attack on America? Was Manhattan gone? Were there hospitals uptown from where they were? So the thing that they had to do was just look where they saw the emergency lights, which were across the river in New Jersey, and they said, let's go to the boats. And that's how it began.
Now, to keep it in perspective, and I didn't even see this in the press materials until just now, but reading your book all the way through, all I could think about is what this reminds me of the Dunkirk evacuation in June of 1940. And the, you know, over 300,000 soldiers were evacuated. And in that particular case, the Nazis kind of just by and took pot shots at them, but they let all these little private craft, for whatever reason, get in there. And the miracle of Dunkirk, as they used to refer to it. And you have almost an identical situation here where you have anything that floats comes over to help out on 9/11.
You know, it's absolutely a great metaphor. It's a great analogy. Dunkirk, though, took 5 days.
Right.
It took 12 hours. And you know, as I interviewed some of the mariners, the almost the ubiquitous response was, I had to do something. You know, whether they were at home and they saw it on TV and they lived down near the docks, or whether they were caught. You have to remember, New York City is sometimes called three islands and a peninsula. You know, we have Staten Island, we have Long Island, we have Manhattan. They're islands. And
right.
So the mariners would look across the water and see these burning towers and think instantly, I've got to do something.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it was very much like Dunkirk. They all started to sail towards the problem, toward Manhattan.
And in such a short amount of time, and when they're coming over, they're bringing, as the day progresses, EMTs and firefighters and nurses and doctors and supplies of all kinds. You know, it seemed to all of us back here. And I know it seemed to them in the middle of it that this was nothing but chaos, but I'm really impressed by the fact of how well they started organizing on the fly to say, okay, we need to get these people to boats. How do we get them safely to boats? And so forth. And you you talk about the all of these different types of boats that operate in and around Hudson River and that or that happen to be in the area, you know, providentially were there, and how many people each of these, even little private craft, how many, you have the accounting of how many get moved out of danger's way, harm's way, into safety and to hospitals and such during this handful of hours. It's amazing.
Well, you know, it's two parts. I mean, first, you know, the towers are struck on 9/11. It's a beautiful day. It couldn't have been a nicer day. There was no humidity. The temperatures were right. It's the first week in September, and everyone is out enjoying the morning. And the plane hits the tower, and almost instantly, I mean, within seconds, the alarms go out, and medics and firemen start to stream down to the World Trade Centers. And these people are right away flooded by injuries. There's a terribly burned person because of the fire that came down the elevator shafts. There's several terribly burned people. At first, they're sent uptown because there's an escape route, there's an egress route. But then the second tower is hit, and more debris showers down, and more people are wounded. And yet these EMS and the medics are beginning to get a sense of organization. They're beginning to set up their triage areas. They're beginning to get a flow. They're overwhelmed, but they're beginning to handle it. And then the tower collapses. And really, that's the second chapter of this horrible, horrible day.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, it was almost impossible to go uptown. A big pedestrian bridge blocks the main road uptown. They really have to start doing something else. And that something else was go to the boats. So while the medics and the mariners around the base of the towers in this confusion, in this cloud, in this debris, surrounded by death, the sailors and the mariners are looking at this massive cloud of dust, not knowing what's inside of it. It could have been terribly hot. Thermal heat could have melted their boats. There could have been debris. And yet they, these mariners, just sailed right in, often using radar, to find a place to dock and to evacuate the injured. So the medics and the mariners really came together and saved thousands of lives. Incredible story.
As they're going through the water, they normally have an eye out for debris because there's going to be debris in any body of water, and this connects to the ocean, so anything can come in, and boats sink and so forth. I mean, all kinds of things. But with the in this situation, they're going through waters that are filled with other boats, all trying to do the same thing, and for a while, the area around the dock where they're docking, there's all this toxic dust that's in the air. It must have been an extraordinary situation, and these guys just seem to handle it like, well, this is what we do. This is what we're going in to save people, because that's what we're trying to do, and that's what we're going to do. Just dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of boats that are in the water during this time, back and forth. And like you said, it's not that far a trip across from Manhattan to Jersey. And so they just keep making trips back and forth.
The Staten Island ferry system was in operation, those big orange boats that all of us have seen. And they just started, as you said, going back and forth. They took 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people per load, instantly turned around and went back. Then you had the Circle Line cruise boats and the other different types of dinner boats that normally ply the waters of the harbor. Almost all of them instantly started to divert their people down to the docks, demand their boats, and start evacuations. And they had tugboats. These tug captains were really instrumental in organizing the civilian mariners and giving them a sense of order. But then on the scene were, of course, the Coast Guard boats. They were one of the first responders.
Right.
And they were some of the first to organize a system of pulling a tugboat up against the seawall of Manhattan, loading them up, moving them off, putting another tugboat in, loading them up with survivors, and moving them off. And so they combined with the harbor pilots that navigate the shoals through the mouth of the Verrazano Narrows. So you really had every form of boat that's known to man, participating in this humanitarian boat lift that really began spontaneously and continued really through most of that day until it kind of came to a halt sort of in the evening when the last boat pulled in. He describes his searchlight hitting the east side of Manhattan and a couple of people looking like zombies coming out of the dust in the dark to be the last loads that went off Manhattan by boat. Just amazing visuals.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Doug Keeney, who is the author of The Lives They Saved, The Untold Story of Medics, Mariners, and the Incredible Boat Lift that Evacuated Nearly 300,000 People on 9/11. It's from Lions Press, and we'll talk a little bit more about Doug's website and how you can find the book. It's at bookstores and online. Is worth you looking for it because it is an extraordinary book. You've got interviews with hundreds of people who were EMPs, EMTs, and nurses, and doctors, and firefighters, and police, and also people that were trying to escape the attack that you talked to and got their eyewitness accounts. It really gives you a sense of being back in it again. As I was reading the book, it all came back in a big flood to me of what it was like that day, because we were sitting here and we had a monitor on, and for whatever reason, we had a TV monitor in our radio studio, and the shift was changing. I was just about to take over when the first plane hit, and we thought, wow, what a crazy thing that is. And wow, look at the damage it's doing. I think we were on ABC at the time, and so we just stayed on ABC Radio Network, and they did like everybody else did, start doing continuous coverage. Mm-hmm. And then the second one hits, and we realized, uh-oh. And that seems to be the same exact reaction that everybody in New York City has, is, uh-oh. This is not just a fluke. This is serious. And one of the things that I kind of forgotten about, but during the day, and you have so many of the people that you talk to mention this, they wondered, will there be more?
Yeah. They really thought this was the beginning of something. I mean, you said it right. The first plane, people thought, well, maybe a little Cessna was off course. The second plane was a terror. I mean, it was just instant. We're at war, or they felt it was a terrorist attack. Some of the people on the New Jersey side, a lot of people saw the second plane. The first plane kind of came over everyone's shoulder, kind of came out of nowhere. Some saw it. There is video of it. You've seen the video. We've all seen it. But the second plane was seen by quite a few people. In fact, one person said, I saw this big silver plane start to descend across New York Harbor, and I thought it was one of those firefighting planes we see out west that drops water on a forest fire, which made kind of sense because you try to fit the narrative to what you believe.
Right.
But it was certainly terror from that moment on. People had no idea how long this was going, if there were more attacks underway, which of course there were, and they were doing everything they could to simply save lives at that point.
And of course, even though there were four planes involved, there could have been a lot more, because we have hundreds of planes in the air all the time, especially from major airports. And as we learned to our chagrin on 9/11, an airplane that's absolutely crammed full of jet fuel makes a really great missile.
It's a missile. It's absolutely a missile. And you have to remember, too, in a lot of, as you said at the preamble, it's 20 years now. Many of your listeners weren't born then. And, you have to remember that at Ground Zero, they didn't have the TV coverage. They weren't hearing any of the news. There wasn't a 30,000-foot perspective. They were down in the dust and in the grit horrible to say, but body parts and blood and wrecked vehicles. It was chaos, and they had no idea what was going on except what was going on within arm's reach of where they stood. It was really a classic example of survival, but also of people helping people, which was clearly what was going on at Ground Zero.
That's the other part of the story that's so wonderful. I mean, you think we rightly think about the courage of the firefighters and the EMTs and all who go into dangerous situations, who run into the fires, and we should remember. But it also is important for us to know that there were people that were helping other people who were not professionals, but just saw another person in need, and and in a lot of cases, reading the eyewitness accounts, they didn't even know who the person was that was offering them a cup of water or was holding
no
their
idea.
Hand. You know? And they have, and they still don't know. You know, this was a person that they had a contact with for just an instant, and then they didn't, and they don't know if they survived. They don't know their names, but there was a human contact there, because in a situation like that, that's the normal reaction. We reach out to each other.
Yeah. Well, you've all seen the we've all seen the hot dog vendors in New York City. I mean, they're classic. They're part of New York City, the hot dog vendors. And one of the people that really impressed me was a hot dog vendor who was standing near the base of the towers, far enough away to survive, but in the thick of it all. And he just opened it up and started handing out his livelihood. He started handing out the cans of water and the cans of Coke and the whatever he had. He and hundreds of other, as you've just accurately said, he and hundreds of other just started doing the right thing. They just started helping each other out.
Now tell us about and this is something I'd never heard about before either. So tell us about how Ellis Island, where the Statue of Liberty is, became a triage area or a staging area.
Yeah, so interesting that you've studied the book well. I'll give you a high point. The Secret Service has always had designated Ellis Island as an evacuation point should a president visiting New York be attacked in any way or need to be evacuated quickly. And it was just one of those points that they had, that they would evacuate a president to get him out of harm's way. And so it was sort of already driven into the hard drives, the DNA of first responders, to know that Ellis Island was that kind of facility. Now, Ellis has no hospitals. It has no, you know, none of the infrastructure that New Jersey shoreline had. But it was a place that, I would say a couple of thousand of the early injuries were taken, triaged, and then moved across using the land bridge to Jersey, over to Jersey City, to the medical center there. But a lot of the Harbor Patrol boats, which typically are small, like you see on a river, hold 10, 15 people, a lot of the Harbor Patrols and a lot of the emergency responders on the water, it just intuitively went to Ellis Island. They're good docks there because that's a tourist destination to see the immigration center. So a lot of them just instinctively went there, and indeed, you're right, that's where some of the very first boats headed. And then equally, they headed directly across the river to Jersey City, where there is a massive, just a very effective medical center to triage patients. A lot of the burn victims were sent there that didn't go uptown to Cornell.
Something that happened later in the book, they're set up and they're prepared to receive lots of casualties, and they didn't. Later in the day, and they began to realize the reason they weren't getting more casualties is that there were no other people to rescue at this point, or at least not easily rescue. The destruction of the towers, it's easy for us who have never been in a situation like this to underestimate just how much damage and chaos there was, but people dying because they're close to the building and a big hunk of the building falls off and cuts them in half or smashes them. Or an ambulance gets thrown by the wind force of the tower collapsing
the
in on itself.
Yeah,
the concussion wave throws an ambulance at you and crushes you with an ambulance. I mean, every kind of imaginable thing that can happen to people happened to them on that day and in this situation. The some of the photos that you have in the book that show the boats and everything, which is very cool. But also has an aerial view of the wreckage. And in that block, there is
nothing. Survived. Yeah. One of the EMTs described seeing a woman running across the street and her leg snapped between her knee and her ankle. And he describes it in a way that just breaks your heart. What you referred to also is one of the senior EMS officers on scene went down to the Staten Island Ferry Terminal, which they turned into a triage center, and they laid out 30, 40 bunk beds to take the injured. And he walks upstairs and he turns to someone and he only sees one or two people in all of these beds. And he said, "Where are they?" And they look at each other and the unsaid word was, "There are none."
Yeah.
No one got out. And that's sort of a refrain that you hear repeated from the different responders as they told their stories and as I tried to include them in the book. But the suddenness of death, the people that jumped, the carnage was just unspeakable. And and yet through it all with these people that just shouldered on, even with their own injuries.
Yeah.
Even with their own injuries, they reached out and helped another person. It's just a real story of human character.
And it's a story that's so much bigger than we realized at the time. You write in the book about a team of New Jersey State Troopers who come and they make more than 20 trips back and forth across the Hudson. These
fabulous
kind of
person.
Yeah, yeah. These kind of stories, we need to hear them, and we need to be reminded of courage and of sacrifice. At a time I remember 20 years ago, a lot was said about we've made the wrong kind of people heroes. You know, we made heroes out of celebrities, actors, and people like that. And these guys are real heroes. And and we've kind of gotten, now that it's been 20 years, like I said, it's another generation has passed. All of my college students were born after this attack.
Hard to believe.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, I had some students whose dads were firefighters. They were soccer on our soccer team, so they came from upstate New York, and their dads were firefighters, and they kissed them goodbye and said, "I'm going to help," and they didn't see him for 5 or 6 days. They were kindergarten kids, and they didn't know if their daddies were going to make it back or not.
And, unbelievable.
Yeah, and I thought, we really don't have any idea of what it means to be in that situation anymore, because that was so unique. And other countries get that, but we don't. You know?
They kept going back. I mean, that's one of the points you're making, is that, for instance, the New Jersey State Patrol, the Highway Patrol, actually has an ocean-going component, a river-going component to police the terminals. They're massive freight terminals on the New Jersey side of New York Harbor. And three of them were on their normal patrol when the first plane hit. And you can just imagine they're coming around the edge of an island, and they're getting their first view of Manhattan as they're coming under the Bayonne Bridge, and they see this smoke and this fire, and their instinct is right away, head toward it and see what they can do. And as you mentioned, they ended up doing 20 trips, including one of the most incredible stories, which is being at the base of the tower when the second one came down, and it almost turned them over. They almost sunk by the shock wave. And they had 11 or 12 injured people, terribly injured people on board, yet they went on into a small marina that was at the foot of the North Tower. And they didn't want to. They were worried about doing it, but they saw the injured, and they had no choice in their mind. And they went in, they boarded all these injured, and the tower came down, and it almost sunk them. They managed to get out in the utter darkness just by bumping into the walls and bumping into the seawalls and bumping into other boats until they found the mouth of the marina and escaped, and they saved all the people on their boat. Just one of the many stories of individual, they don't want to be called heroes, but just individual sense of duty.
Yeah, yeah. Doing, like you said, doing the right thing. Whatever you could do, that's what you wanted to do.
And that's what they did.
That reminds me that in the book, which I had never thought about before I read your book, that the Coast Guard was afraid that if the towers collapsed in the harbor, they would produce a tsunami that would swamp every single boat, which could have easily happened. Looking at the map that you have in, or the bird's eye view photograph that you have in here, I realize how close they are to the water's edge.
Yeah,
it's just another two blocks or something over.
That's right. They wanted the boats. They asked all the boats to turn their bows toward the island, toward Manhattan, toward New York City, just in case. And it's one of those little things that you never think of, but that is, in fact, was in fact a possibility. Thankfully, it didn't happen. But the Coast Guard did send out an alert to all the boat captains to head up, as they call it, and get your situational awareness ready for what could happen. And thankfully, it did not.
Just incredible. Fishing boat captains, the tugboats that we mentioned, ferry boats, dinner boats, dive boats, debris collection vessels, even the little Zodiac inflatable boat owners. All these people said, we got to help. We got to go right now because we don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, it was quite a thing. And that you really have read the book. That is a diversity of watercraft that came up from a two-person Zodiac to a 6,000-foot ferry, a 6,000-passenger ferry, and they all just responded. They all just came to rescue, and they had to see things that were pretty horrific for you and me to evacuate these injured.
How long did you work on this book?
After 9/11, the Fire Department of New York, FDNY, decided to do some debriefs. They decided to interview as many of the surviving firefighters and EMS crews as they could. So they actually interviewed 583 of them.
Okay.
The transcripts numbered several thousand pages. And I was able to use those transcripts as a basis for my background. So
I read
all 5,000-6,000 pages and selected from them the ones that I think were most emblematic of the overall crisis response, and then I interviewed them.
Gotcha.
So to go to that part, virtually everyone I interviewed, it was rough. It was incredibly rough, not only for me but for them.
Yeah,
because they had to go back, and oftentimes they were reduced to tears. I mean, really strong, you know, tough men and women, and you know, we ended up crying together while we were talking on the phone about what they'd gone through.
Yeah,
a couple of days ago, I got a letter from one of the EMTs, a woman, wonderful woman named Bonnie, and it was a patch from her uniform. And I opened the envelope, and it was a note that just said, "Thank you, Doug."
Wow.
And it was a patch from her uniform that said, you know, just "Thank you, Doug." And and that's the emotion that surrounds this event.
Yeah.
It killed thousands of people. They had no idea what was going on. They began their day at home just like you and I, or most of your listeners did today, and they never came back.
Oh, well, Doug, it is an incredible story, and it's encouraging and it is challenging. It makes you think, well, if these people did this, what would I do in this situation? I'd hope I'd be one of those people that would jump in the boat and go, and if I did, what would, you know, how would I help? So it encourages us to think, as that old Boy Scout motto, to be prepared. Think about if you ran up on even something a lot less complicated than this, but nonetheless, somebody in mortal peril, how would you help them? What would you do maximize the possibility of rescuing somebody? So
absolutely, and you know that one of the nice things about all of this that you're referring to is almost universally everybody helped. I mean, it ran across every demographic, every income, everyone just pitched in, and it was a city doing what it does best. One person said, New York at its best is a New York in crisis, and it sure proved to be the case.
Doug Keeney, our guest today. His new book, The Lives They Saved, The Untold Story of Medics, Mariners, and the Incredible Boat Lift That Evacuated Nearly 300,000 People on 9/11. It's from Lions Press. Doug, I know you're the author of a lot of interesting books. I've read some of them, but I have not read the Doomsday Scenario, so now I'm going to go on Amazon or something and find a copy of that one.
Okay.
Can people go to, do you have, is your website like L. Douglas Keeney or... .com.
Well, it's StardustKeeney.com, but it's more of an author page. Really, the book's available at Barnes & Noble or on Amazon or your local books store. Lions Press is a major publisher in New York City, and it's widely available. Please feel free to go to my website, but it's not where you would buy the book.
Okay.
Just go to your bookstore and tell them hello.
Doug, thank you so much. A wonderful book. Thank you for spending time, and I know we could talk for another hour or so, but I appreciate you making a half an hour available for us today.
Sure. Absolutely. Enjoy your show. You're just a wonderful host. Thanks for including me.
Oh, thank you, sir. And our thanks again to Doug Keeney, the author of The Lives They Saved, The Incredible Story of Medics, Mariners, and the Incredible Boat Lift That Evacuated Nearly 300,000 People on 9/11. Boats like from the New York Waterway, the Staten Island Ferry System, the Circle Line, the Spirit Cruises, tugboats, the NY Fast Ferries, dinner boats and cruise boats, Sea Streak, Harbor Patrol boats, U.S. Army Corps, VIP yacht cruises, Fox Navigation, fire boats, and of course, U.S. Coast Guard, all contributing. Doug is also best known for unearthing the official U.S. manual on how the government would function after a devastating nuclear attack, the basis for his book, The Doomsday Scenario, as well as the exhaustive history of the air war against Nazi Germany and the Point Blank Directive, The 11th Hour, about FDR's trip to the 1943 Tehran Conference, and he was the editor of the Lost Histories of World War II book series as well. We appreciate you taking time to listen and to remember what happened 20 years ago. We dare not forget. On the bookshelf, on the radio, and on my podcast, Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.